The WA committee meeting, my apology for starting late. The agenda before us today is a discussion on CRIMNET data practices. There's been some recommendations by the CRIMNET policy group that are now finalized.
Yeah.
The schedule this morning is we will first hear from Tom Coy with CRIMNET. Next we'll hear some discussion and presentation by Bob Sikora, who was before the committee earlier relative to the working group that worked on putting together recommendations for legislation related to data practices in CRIMNET. We will then hear presentations from the different databases that are part of CRIMNET at this time. In order to provide some framework for the committee work today, we forwarded to these groups a list of 19 questions to try and ascertain each database's procedures and policies relative to compliance with the Minnesota Data Practices Act. So in your packets is quite a volume of paperwork addressing those 19 questions. I'd like to first thank Dana Goetz for her work in getting all this paperwork together. I realize that the time frame was rather short, and for everybody in this room that helped prepare the documents, we appreciate your efforts in having that information before us as we move into the session and try and address some of these important issues. For a matter of update, I'm sure most members in the room are aware of the Police Chiefs database, the Multiple Jurisdiction Network Organization. That database was shut down at the Police Chief Association's direction the week of December 15th. But I think that there were important value to that database, and I believe that there are people that are working on trying to reconstruct a similar database that would serve the important function while still conforming to the state laws. So that's something that has happened since we last discussed this issue. Mr. Coy, if you'd like to step to the table. Bob Johnson, unfortunately, again, is out of town. I seem to have a knack for scheduling meetings when he's not in town. I assured him that when we actually hear the bill during session, I will consult his schedule before scheduling that bill for hearing, but in his stead we have Mr. Coy, who's very competent in these issues as well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Coy. I'm one of the deputy directors of the CRIMNET project at the BCA. If I could take just a couple of minutes, I know a report to the legislature, as was due, was delivered this past week, and for members of the committee who may not be familiar with the development of CRIMNET over the last couple of years, exactly what CRIMNET is and how it works with the other criminal justice databases, to give you a little bit of an introduction of that summary, some of the concepts of what CRIMNET is and what CRIMNET is not and how it operates for your edification. In 1993, when the Minnesota legislature enacted 299C65, it created the Criminal and Juvenile Information Policy Group. The policy group had the responsibility for criminal justice information systems and systems integration, and began the planning and improvement stages of systems that existed at that time. Looking at upgrading systems, modernizing some of the technologies that were being used and trying to move them into more common and shareable platforms. It was not until 2001 that CRIMNET itself was conceived and received its first funding for statewide integration work that began in mid-2001. This integration initiative is what was led to allow the criminal justice agencies, some 1,100 different agency data systems statewide, to be able to communicate more effectively with one another. The idea that once complete, CRIMNET could give Minnesota's prosecutors, judges, law enforcement officers, and probation and corrections officials timely access to the comprehensive information from criminal juvenile justice that they need in the daily work of their duties. And the vision was to ensure that we could have the right information in the hands of the right people at the right time and place. a common misperception that we've recognized about CRIMNET is that it is a centralized database. It's only natural that in the process of technology over the last 15 or 20 years, particularly at state and federal levels, to try and draw information together, it was conceived that you would put all the information in one large super database. That has never been the concept of CRIMNET. It's been strongly avoided. Employing internet-style technologies to leverage the data from different data source systems where they exist. Also, it makes good fiscal sense to not reinvent these systems or to duplicate these systems. Like the internet, the CRIMNET is a system of systems. It's really a data delivery system. Never a single database. It's not even really an application. It is a set of services and discrete development projects separate when we think about applications, what are the data issues around them. The data issues, for the most part, as appropriately asked by the set of surveys that have gone to the data systems, remain at the data systems and the responsibility of the data with the source owners, whether it be a police chief, whether it be a state organization. Just as the internet or the web enables access to a vast range of independent websites and information sources through an internet connection or a standard browser, CRIMNET provides authorized users only access to an ever-growing quantity of data, applications, and information sources from across the justice community, but they're still owned and maintained by those source systems. Those are individual state, county, city agencies. What CRIMNET is, fundamentally, when we talk about the technology of it, is this integration backbone. It's a central platform. If you think of it in terms of your own PC, it's the operating system. It's the thing that allows other applications to run in one environment and run together effectively. It supports two key functions. First is that it provides the connections and the interfaces that make previously standalone applications available to authorized users throughout the state. So it's particularly important for all our out-state criminal justice agencies who do not have as much access to statewide systems or access to the criminal justice data network. Secondly, the backbone acts as a central broker or index to what data is out there, making it possible for a criminal justice professional who has a need to know to effectively find and manage the data they need in a timely fashion for both public safety and for officer safety. And yet again, agencies retain the ownership and the control of that source system and the data responsibilities. They link them to the backbone, but that does not change the data practices of those data in those systems, nor that responsibility. Today, CRIMNET has over 1,000 pilot users. We are in a pilot phase that rolled out earlier in 2003. When we say pilot phase, we're talking about early stages of functionality and not becoming yet a full production system. Not all services, not all data have been rolled out, and we are working through a number of the issues with respect to user access, security, and so forth before we go into production. The main functionality that is being delivered today is the search functionality for a user to come in and be able to authenticate themselves and their privileges against the available data and databases and be able to run common queries against those data. So very much it acts like a portal. The users are criminal justice professionals who include crime analysts, law enforcement investigators, dispatch personnel, patrol officers, court administrators, judges, corrections supervisors, probation officers, corrections officers, county attorneys, state troopers, correctional officers, and detention deputies. Specific repositories and even specific data fields, right down to particular data elements, are classified and secured through profiles, meaning each of these types of criminal justice professionals have a different profile that tells CRIMNET which systems they have access to, and within those, which data they can have access to through that profile and through the policies of each of those data systems. Some of the benefits of CRIMNET today include, of the functionality includes the single sign-on, which means coming into CRIMNET, I sign on once, and I'm authenticated as appropriate into the other systems that I have access to. Previously, you may have had access to 5 or 6 or 8 different systems. You had different passwords. You had to go to different sites and run separate queries in each of those systems. It was not effective. It was not integrated. It was not timely. We are looking at increasing the strong authentication for security, being able to bring that kind of single sign-on and accessibility further out into the remote field during this pilot. Time spent for individuals who are looking for relevant data this way is dramatically reduced, and statewide information is quickly made available through that single interface. PrimNet currently encompasses 5 operating components of source systems, as you have received information to during the course of the morning here. We will talk about each of those systems and the data practices that are respective to each of those systems. The PrimNet search capability, which we are piloting today, for us is a big accomplishment. Pilot users, the 1,000 or so users that are already using the receiving results, are having tremendous success solving crimes, reducing their costs, reducing the time they spent investigating cases, and making better and more accurate decisions with more complete data. Most notably, a serial burglary case was solved by Chaska Police Department out in Carver County thanks to the use of PrimNet. And this past summer, a serious community church arson fire in Burnsville was solved in a very timely fashion thanks to the use of the PrimNet system. We've made great progress in the last couple of years with PrimNet, having got a very real and tangible product into pilot phase that's being used, that's solving crimes and potentially saving lives. The PrimNet won't be complete until all jurisdictions statewide are a part of the entire enterprise, this enterprise system, in which all components have been attached and integrated, both for communication and for sharing. Once fully operational, PrimNet will improve public safety, enable swifter and more effective criminal justice processes throughout the state of Minnesota. Another point that we would like to make is that this is a common vision both for technology and for government, which is growing. The vision for PrimNet is to be linked to other justice systems eventually in other states as well as the federal level, contributing to a national network of shared data and business processes that will enable public safety and justice professionals to more easily and rapidly collaborate on a broad range of critical issues. The PrimNet architecture is aligned with the guidelines that are coming out of the Department of Justice, the Office of Justice Programs, and the Global Advisory Process under the Attorney General, and has been fundamental in developing standards for the law enforcement and intelligence sharing products that have come out under Homeland Security, under Global. One of the byproducts recently, and PrimNet has a vital part, is producing a National Justice Data Dictionary and a common XML computer language and a national criminal justice data model. The first interim operational capability release of a national XML data model, largely contributed to and influenced by the work here in Minnesota and the PrimNet project, was released nationally last Thursday. U.S. Department of Justice and their law enforcement sharing initiatives, Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, CIA, Secret Service are all adopting this standard model. We've also been working with the FBI and their index system, their system of services project, through Global, working with the risk sharing community, with the law enforcement online community through the FBI, and have contributed to the National Criminal Intelligence Sharing Plan through the Global under the auspices of the Department of Justice. It should be recognized that in this direction, it seems to be in which business process and technology is being re-engineered in every aspect of business and government. from the Federal Enterprise Architecture Model coming out of OMB in the White House, and the National Association of State Chief Information Officers, also known as NASIO, integration and information sharing in this way is becoming a major priority. The enterprise integration approach has become the standard, both in industry and now moving into government. It aligns business processes and resources across multiple lines of business or government, and it was at the inception and the fundamental design of PrimNet. It's now that these standards and business concepts are fast becoming requirements for many states and federal programs. OMB is looking to make sure that all federal-funded programs in 04 that deal with technology meet the DRM and TRM models coming out of FEPMO in the OMB Architecture Office. It's very likely that requirements such as the National Justice XML model may be standards-based requirements for federal grants coming out of Homeland Security in 04-05, as well as burn grants, LLEBG block grants, out of Department of Justice. We can anticipate that in the future years, many state and federal agencies will mandate these requirements and make them stipulations of even local state programs. And this brings us into that common enterprise of using standards-based and open architecture models that allow and facilitate better sharing of information, better use of our information technology dollars, and better and more effective government programs. This does not obviate the need for policy as we put these programs into place, and we're happy to have the discussion today about what the system is, where it's going, how it's being designed, and what it means to data practices under our current laws. PrimNet continues to participate in state and national forums. We are helping to develop and create some of those emerging standards, and in as much have some leeway into respect of data practices and security and privacy policies at the state and federal levels. But it should be understood that enterprise integration is becoming a standard for business and government, and it's a shifting paradigm when we begin to look at data practices, security, and data quality management. Copies of the report to the legislature have been given to leadership, and Madam Chair, for those in the committee who would want a copy of that, we can make sure that if you don't already have a copy, that you distribute it amongst the Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Clay, I did receive a copy of that report in email, and I'd be happy to forward it to all committee members and staff.
With respect to that, one of the agenda items I think that was germane to the original hearing that was postponed because the policy group had not given approval to was referenced in the recommendations to the legislature with respect to data practices, and that is attachment D to this report. And with us this morning to discuss those recommendations is Mr. Robert Sikora from the State Board of Public Defense, and he serves as the co-chair of the task force under the policy group. He's been a member and a part of that board and working as a part of what today we call a delivery team, have been a subcommittee on data practices and data procedures that's been in place over 3 years. And what those recommendations brought forward by that delivery team to the task force, from the task force to the policy group, have finally come forth as recommendations to the legislature. And so to speak to those points this morning, I'd like to bring up Mr. Robert Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Well, Mr. Sikora is coming to the stand. Representative Coles moves approval of the minutes of the Tuesday, December 2nd meeting. Are there any questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from December 2nd meeting are approved. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sikora. The committee has quite a number of documents in front of it. I'm assuming that you're going to be referring to the Appendix D document that was not included in your folder but at your place when you arrived this morning. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Let's talk about data practices and data policy. My friends ask me what I'm doing nowadays, and I tell them, you know, I spend a lot of my time in rooms full of really smart people talking about how to design data policy and data practices in a way that serves the public interest and doesn't hurt people. And I get to about that point, and they sort of lose interest and think that I have a really pathetic life, that I think that's fun.
Mr. Sikora, if you might just state your name for the
sure.
tape.
It's Robert Sikora, and first let me tell you what I am. I'm one of the chairs of the Criminal Juvenile Justice Information Task Force that the legislature created many years ago. It is sometimes wrongly called the CRIMNET Task Force. In fact, CRIMNET is a subset of the interests that we pay attention to. We were working on these issues before CRIMNET was called CRIMNET. I have 18 years of experience as a lawyer, both in the courtroom and in working for the Board of Public Defense, designing databases and working with the techies and the database programmers to implement those databases. What I'm not is an authority on the Data Practices Act. We have one of those. He's in the room. He's has even more white hair than I do. I'm also not an expert on CRIMNET. That person sitting right next to me. This process, as Mr. Coy indicated, began in 01. I began to become involved as a member of the task force in 02. We had meetings throughout 2002 to discuss these issues. Just framing the questions took an amazing amount of time because the issues are new ones. The issues that are created by these systems that cross agency lines are very complicated. Mr. Coy uses the phrase enterprise integration. What that really means is quite substantial, and the application of rules to that process becomes quite complex. The task force developed a set of specific questions for its data policy delivery team that we began to work on in the spring of 03. Our meetings monthly, sometimes twice monthly, through 2003 were just about always packed. And it was pretty much table-pounding, bug-eyed disagreement at every meeting. We had two and a half hour meetings to develop the answers to the questions that I'm going to discuss with you today. We started turning over our proposals to the task force in September of 03. The task force is made up sort of similar spread of professionals as the data practices delivery team. We always call the makeup the Noah's Ark because there are two sheriffs, two prosecutors, two defenders, two courts people. So we have a wide collection of people involved in that discussion. I think the current membership of the task force involves 27 people and members of the public. We had, in addition to the folks that make up the task force, we invited media lawyers to become part of our discussion at the delivery team level. We invited the general counsel for the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union to be involved in our discussion, all with the desire of getting input from a wide range of individuals on the issues that we're going to discuss today. The task force dealt with these questions in September and October and November, and again, we would have an hour and a half long debate at the task force as different members modified and had questions about the recommendations. That set of recommendations that came out of the task force then went to the policy group, which, as you know, is made up of a Supreme Court justice, appellate court and trial court judge, the state court administrator, and the commissioners of finance, administration, corrections, and public safety. Those eight individuals then deliberated on the recommendations, made yet more changes, and it is that set of recommendations that is delivered to you for our discussion today. So, all of that said, I ask you to refer to Appendix D, which is on page 39 of your packet, and we're going to discuss now ways that CRIMNET is going to comply with Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, understand that one of the constitutional elements set forth in the strategic plan for CRIMNET, which you also have in your packet, is CRIMNET will not abet source systems violations of the Data Practices Act. Another word that you'll hear discussed a lot, especially by the chair of this committee, is buckets. The buckets and the source systems are the same thing. The phrase buckets came out of this PowerPoint presentation that showed all these agencies as separate buckets and CRIMNET being a single pipe that connected each of those buckets. So what the strategic plan tells you is that it is in CRIMNET's constitution, its strategic plan, not to allow the buckets to violate the Data Practices Act, in addition to the following recommendations that we're going to discuss. Now, I've been doing this so long and I've been having these conversations with so many people, I sometimes lose perspective on when I'm getting into too much detail. So you guys get to do the too much information sign for me if I'm getting down to too nitty-gritty a level. So I'll just kind of be alert to that signal from you. If we could begin with Section 1, it's a simple sort of concept. The suggestion was made that there are a lot of data practices recommendations or requirements throughout statute, and it becomes difficult to interpret data practices limitations because you have to search through so many different sections. So the Section 1 is simply a cross-reference that allows people to keep track of where this recommendation is in Minnesota statutes. Section number 2, the question that was asked of us is what should happen to information when it flows across the separation of powers. In other words, when it flows from the courts, one of the biggest sources of information in this area, to other branches of government, that is, into CRIMNET. So we basically asked the courts what they wanted in order to share data across that separation of powers. And the language that you see suggesting a subdivision 4 under 13.03, and which is Section 2 of your grid, is the language proposed by the courts. It will then be clear which rules apply when judicial branch data is sent to and used by executive and legislative branches.
Mr. Secor, if you could hold for just a second. Representative Lippman has a question on this point. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Secor, just to this point, mindful that the judicial branch isn't subject to the Data Practices Act. They have a different scheme entirely. And we have an opinion in our packet from Commissioner Lamb suggesting that when information moves between different agencies of government, it doesn't become the designation or collection doesn't become more restrictive at the receiving agency than it does from the originating agency or the transmitting agency. I'm just wondering if the judicial branch has different sets of rules and they're not the Data Practices Act, are there conflicts or problems where when it transfers from the court, either a broader designation is given or a more restrictive designation is given when you move across the separation of powers boundary.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, it's not entirely true that information does not become more restrictive upon transfer. There are occasions when it becomes more restrictive, and an important point is arrest data, which we always want to be public at the local police station, becomes private once it's consolidated in the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension database. So there are some exceptions to that rule. And there will be some exceptions when the court data flows across the separation of powers because it will retain the data practices, or it will retain the classification that it had when the judiciary had it.
I'm going to have to think about that answer, but perhaps I don't want to hold up the rest of them, but perhaps I can ponder that. I'd like to follow up perhaps later.
Okay.
Mr. Secor.
Can we move on to Section 3, Subdivision 1? And the question that was asked of us, we better get some definitions, folks, before we start making the rules about this stuff. So that's what Section 3, Subdivision 1 is all about. How are CRIMNET data defined? When does information continue to be the responsibility of the bucket, the originating agency, the source system, and under what circumstances does it become CRIMNET's responsibility? And what new terms do we need to have defined in statute? So we've defined what CRIMNET is. We've defined it as being subject to Chapter 13. We have defined what audit trail data is. Think of those buckets. Think of that pipe. Under the simplest scenario in the first rollout of CRIMNET, That pipe is just transmitting information from one bucket to the user. It's not retaining information. So what rules need to apply? Well, suddenly the system, well, not suddenly, but as the system develops, it'll start keeping track of that data in order to audit it. So if a police officer is making a stop at 12:02 in the morning based on information that she got from CrimNet, there would be an audit possible to show that, yeah, at 11:59 she got information about a warrant, and that's why she made the stop. Or it's audited to show that people aren't abusing it. I don't know why, but we've always had the example of the angry ex-boyfriend come up at moments when it comes to audit discussion about audits, wanting to make sure that if information is being accessed, it's being accessed for legitimate reasons. So CrimNet, that pipe suddenly starts keeping track of information. Who got what information when? Now CrimNet owns data. And that's what the definition of audit trail data is about in Section 3, Subdivision 1. The next issue, Section 3, Subdivision 2, has to do quite a bit with Representative Lippman's question, because it discusses how, or it deals with the questions created by different classifications of the same data in the possession of different agencies. That creates an enormous number of practical policy issues. The example I used to respond to Representative Lippman's question was how arrest data, public as we always want it to be, because we don't want secret arrests, public at the local level becomes private at the state level once it's consolidated at the BCA. Why do we do that? There's a case the Supreme Court of the United States came down with in 1989 that said individuals have a privacy interest in data once it is consolidated at the statewide or national level. So there are reasons why there should be exceptions to this traveling data concept. It's important to understand that point, and I predict as you go through the session, you will spend the most of your time debating issues around this very point, because it takes a while to understand it, and everybody seems to have a strong opinion about it. There are also discussions, and you will have these, about the private data harvesters. I told you that arrest data is public at the local cop shop. Well, Thompson West and RentalResearch.com and SmokingGun.com and really a limitless collection of private data harvesters, they send somebody to the local cop shop and they download data into a laptop, or they get a CD-ROM, or they connect their machine to the local database and they pull down that arrest information. They compile it in useful ways and they sell it to paying customers. I own a little duplex. I have an account with RentalResearch.com. I go there and I click the buttons and I see whether or not my potential tenants have arrest records. Even me, that, you know, the I'm probably most concerned about these privacy issues, and I'm very conscious of the fact that when I do that, I'm stepping right on that line I'm talking about being careful about consolidated information. Well, the question is, if private data harvesters are doing this, does the state want to get into the business of doing that? Do we want to compete with private enterprise? Do we want to take on the transaction costs of doing it, the liability risks of doing it, if private enterprise is already doing it? And the recommendation that's come out of the process that I've described for you is no, we don't want to do that. CrimNet has been developed as a law enforcement and criminal justice agency tool, and we don't want to get in the business of providing information directly to the public. So that is the real meat of the recommendation that is set forth in this section. The next section, Section 3, Subdivision 3, sounds like a really simple question, and it sounded like that to me when we began discussing it 2 years ago.
Can we back up just a second? You kind of slid over the audit trail not being available to the public. How would an individual find out if people were making unauthorized inquiries under CRIMNET on them?
Sure. The last, let's see, I guess it's, that's one heck of a long sentence. It's the last sentence of Subdivision 3, Madam Chair, that you're referring to. In addition to other routine audits, CRIMNET shall conduct audits of system use based on complaints made by data subjects who believe that unauthorized access, think of the angry boyfriend, has occurred. And the CRIMNET responsible authority, who is an individual designated by Chapter 13, makes a determination that wrongdoing might have occurred, and they do an investigation. We had quite a bit of debate about this, and at one stage our proposals were, hey, the entire audit trail should be available to the individual. If I, Robert Sikora, go and ask CRIMNET, who got information about me, who asked for information about me, and when? The entire trail. Well, Officer so-and-so asked on this day, Officer so-and-so asked on that day, Probation Officer X asked on that day. And we moved away from that with fear about compromising law enforcement investigations and possibly even putting people at risk during an active law enforcement investigation. It's difficult for the pipe to know what stage the bucket is at. Is that in the middle of an active investigation, or is the investigation closed? It's not built in a way so that we can determine that. So providing the full open access to audit trail data to the individual subject of the data could put law enforcement people at risk as they try to protect the public safety. So the position that we then moved to is we want to protect individuals from inappropriate use, you know, from the person whose ex-boyfriend is a cop and who has access to CRIMNET and who is going to inappropriately look at information. So we will provide a scenario where the individual can go to CRIMNET and say, I think unauthorized access has occurred. I want you to investigate it and provide the results of your investigation to me.
Representative Lippman.
Since we're moving briefly in reverse, I would like to to go back to the question, because I'm not sure I understood Mr. Sikora's answer. And again, if you could, in the context of the arrest data hypothetical, where locally it is one designation, but when it's merged and collected or held at the state level, it's another designation. I'm looking at 1303 subdivision 4C, and I know that I have the statute book and you don't, but I'll just read briefly. To the extent that government data is disseminated to state agencies or subdivisions or statewide systems by another state agency or a political subdivision, the data disseminated shall have the same classification in the hands of the agency receiving it as in the hands of the agency providing it. That seems to be at odds with the description that you just gave me, and I realize that there's some verbiage above that about judicial and administrative rules, and you mentioned a Supreme Court case. Do I have it correctly that the Supreme Court case that you talked about trumps this statute, which seems to provide for the same classification once the state has it as opposed to local subdivisions? And perhaps if you could talk about it in terms of arrest data so I understand,
sure,
that would be most helpful.
And Mr. Sikora, you're more than welcome to take this one, but we also have our phone a friend, Mr. Gimberling here, who would be willing and able to help
Madam
as well.
Chair and Representative Lippman, we needn't worry about the Supreme Court trumping it, because there's a statute that trumps it. I'm unable to cite chapter and verse, but there's someone here who can.
Welcome
there's a
to
chapter
the
specific to arrest data, or there's a section specific to arrest data.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gimberling.
I'm glad you're here.
Madam Chair, Don Gimberling from the Department of Administration, who, unlike Bob, is conscious of the fact that the tops of our heads is being displayed. Yes, I do indeed have a small bald spot right here.
There is no videotape running, if that make you feel better.
Madam Chair, it's genetic. My dad is.
Well, we would designate it as private, even if it were.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, in the section that you're reading, it goes on to say that data keeps its classification in the receiving agency unless in the receiving agency there's a statute specific to that agency which changes the classification. Actually, the reason that criminal history data are private at the state level, even though all of the source data are public, is, in the words of my criminal law instructor in law school, because the legislature said so.
Okay.
And actually, that's a decision that predates the Reporters Committee case. The legislature decided to have criminal history data private in about 1979. Okay. Why did they do that? Primarily, they did it because criminal history data held by the BCA had always been private. It had never been made available to the public. Now, there was at the time some discussion of the fact that the source data is all public, but the legislature decided because it had always been private, it should continue to be private. Since that time, you've kind of modified that position by saying there is some criminal history data that is treated as public. That's the conviction stuff, and it's only public for a limited period of time. It's either 10 or 15 years. So that's, you know, for the transfer possibilities, what applies here is not the language in 1303. It's really the specific language in 1387 that classifies criminal history data as not as private data.
Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Gimling. Now I understand, because there's a different statute on point, but let me pose to you the earlier question that I posed to Mr. Sikora. Are there problems, are we losing things in translation or having tensions as we upload from the courts, which have a different system that isn't the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Gamberling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, the perception that there may be a problem is the reason why the language that Mr. Sikora has presented to you has been presented. There's, you know, CRIMNET really is the first kind of situation in which there is a mix of judicial branch data and executive branch data. Now, again, back in 1990, the legislature decided to clarify that the judicial branch was not subject to the Data Practices Act. I have to tell you that before that had been kind of an open question, but clearly it is not at this point. So the Supreme Court has developed rules about access to records of the judiciary. Actually, developing the rules was part of the deal to clarify that the judiciary wasn't subject to the Data Practices Act. So those rules have been in effect for over 10 years. Authorization. So I can't tell you at a detail level whether or not there'll be differences, but clearly the idea behind the language is to say when the judicial branch stuff enters the executive branch, because CRIMNET is operated by the executive branch, that it would be treated the same as if it were still in the judicial branch. So a lot of the same stuff is going to be public. I just can't tell you off the top of my head in at any kind of detail level what might be different. The idea is to preserve the separation of powers more than anything else.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gimbelin. Mr. Sikora.
Madam Chair, let's move forward, if we can, then, to requests by data subject. I guess that's kind of where we are already. This is the area where the greatest number of unforeseen issues arose. Imagine you are, working for CRIMNET. Joe Jones comes in and says, "Hi, I'm Robert Sikora, and I'd like information about me." Well, the first thing you're going to do is you want to ask for his identification, and the Data Practices Act has some phrase like, "You may require reasonable identification in order to make certain that the information you're given out is going to the correct person." Oh, even if Robert Sikora comes in and asks for information about Robert Sikora, you may know that you have a colleague, Barbara Sikora. She happens to be married to somebody named Robert Sikora, and as she and I have discussed, her husband and I are very, very different people. my unusual name, I could go in and ask for information about Robert Sikora, and I'd get it on all the Robert Sikoras. Oddly enough, there are a bunch of us. So you want to get birth date. Well, how about if it's Robert Johnson, asking for information on Robert Johnson, and you check the birth date, and it's 1-1-1980, and there are 25 Robert Johnsons with the birth date 1-1-1980. And the Data Practices Act is going to prohibit you from giving private information to anyone except the subject of the data. Now, how do you determine which of the 12 Robert Johnsons with the same birth date you should give the information to? This is very difficult. When you're the pipe, it's a lot easier when you're the bucket, because the bucket may be the Bowabic Police Department, and they may know Robert Johnson personally because they made the arrest. Or they may have the fingerprint records that they can use to compare to make sure they're giving the information to the correct person. So it is with that in mind that we began to develop policies that refer people to the bucket. There are some other restrictions as well. Information in the bucket may change classification from day to day. In an example using law enforcement, it may be an active investigation one week, in which case the information is confidential, and inactive the next, in which case it's private and can be disclosed to the data subject. And then something happens, the police reinitiate their investigation, and it's confidential again. Well, those changes of data classifications in the local buckets, in the local source systems, may happen on a very volatile basis. It can change really from day to day or week to week as different things happen in law enforcement. So our discussions then were, who's in a better position to know what the current classification is? The bucket, the source system. So again, we want to refer people to that source system rather than saying, well, CRIMNET in its omniscient power is able to understand exactly what the data classification is day to day. There are also some practical concerns. Well, we had one proposal at one point saying anybody who has access to CRIMNET should be able to give information out to the subject of the data. Well, that becomes difficult right away because not everybody has the full access to CRIMNET. You know, public defenders are going to have some access to CRIMNET, but I can guarantee you it's going to be a very narrow slice of the whole information available. Probation officers will have a broader collection. Law enforcement will have the broadest possible collection of access to those buckets, where I might be able to have access to two or three buckets. That's not going to do the subject of data any good when they want to know what the whole system has on them. So again, we start referring people this time to law enforcement, saying go to your local law enforcement agency and have them do a system-wide search for you because they have the broadest access to this collection of buckets. We had some concern raised by people about cost. A county commissioner involved in the task force raised the concern about what if my local cop shop has CRIMNET access and the neighboring county doesn't. and now all the neighboring county people come over and burden my police officers and my cop shop asking for information. Other law enforcement representatives said, well, this is an unfunded mandate. You're asking us to do all of this providing of information, but you know, you're not giving us money to provide the support staff to sit at the front desk to respond to those questions. Those were difficult questions, and I got to say we didn't resolve them. I didn't have an answer for the county commissioner about her cheapskate neighboring county trying to save money.
Mr. Segura?
Yes.
In this discussion, was there anything that you heard that would have prohibited law enforcement agencies from identifying the status of a case file, the active or inactive, on the system?
I think it would be difficult, say an individual in Bowabic goes to the Bowabic PD, they do a system-wide search, it's difficult for them to know what the Bloomington PD is currently classifying. But it's possible for them to talk to the Bloomington PD and find out.
But
it is still, it's a fairly manual effort. I mean, imagine you go into the Bowabic PD and you say, show me everything on Mary Liz Holberg, and they say, well, we've got something from Bloomington, something from Lakeville. We'll have to call them to find out whether it's okay to give that information out.
But would not you be able to have a data field in this system that you would click on if it was part of an active investigation and click off if it was not?
I think it's possible. When the legislature began this discussion and began really talking about the design of CRIMNET, the focus was on creating a law enforcement tool. And it was not part of the design or the mandate that came from the legislature to provide information to the public as a central function of CRIMNET. So there has not been in the design so far the implementation of the field that you've just described. I think it's technically something that can be discussed. I'm not enough of a techie to know to be able to tell you whether it's possible or not. It's a good idea. I like it as something that would make the system responsive to the individuals. But you have to understand it's an expansion of the original idea of CRIMNET, and it's kind of a complex issue of keeping that information current.
Madam Chair, if I may, just from a technical perspective, it was always anticipated that we would capture or have the ability to capture and operate against that kind of what we call metadata. So the things about a record of information is additional data that tells us what kind of information this is, the current classification, active or closed case. That functionality was always anticipated, built into CRIMNET. It's capable of that. What's problematic at this point is the source systems themselves either don't have that captured or don't report that as that metadata as a part of it. So that's a part of the evolutionary process, is that we've built that capability. Those source systems would have to begin to be required to capture and report that metadata along with the record. And until that's there, we again are forced, as Ms. Piscicora says, to go back to the agency and ask them, what's the nature of this record? Can it be shared? I think, to Ms. Piscicora's point, we agree it was not one of the priorities from the legislature that this would be a delivery system to the public. But as we've discussed in other forums, and you and I have discussed, it could be an excellent forum for, at a minimum, taking away the obscurity of where are records about me, getting rid of the bureaucratic wild goose chase of where do I begin to go to source agencies to know if I found all the data about me, and at least give the members of the public an ordered list of a wild goose chase to say these are the 18 agencies, but you do have to deal with them individually until we can start to capture that metadata and operate the way CRIMNET would be possible to do in the future.
And I guess I just want to add this point. I think, yes, the legislature, intended this to be a law enforcement tool, but I don't believe they ever intended to loosen the standards of the data practices as a exception to this law enforcement tool, and subject access to data on themselves has always been a very important element of government holding data on individuals, and I don't think we should lose sight of that important element. It is the public that is paying for this system to be put into place, and their rights should be respected as well. Mr. Score, you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also, just to touch before we move on the Supreme Court case from 1989, which is called Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press versus Department of Justice, and the issue that Mr. Gemberling came up to discuss in response to Representative Lippman's question, one of the comments in that Supreme Court case is the consolidation of this data vastly increases the potential for abuse. And, Madam Chair, your comment about keeping the system responsive to the individual, allowing the individual to see what data is being consolidated about her or him, helps protect against potential abuses. So I agree, it's an essential component to keep the system fair.
Okay. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cora, under this Subdivision 3, it provides that CRIMNET would conduct audits to see if there's been an abuse of the system. It doesn't say what happens if you find an abuse. Is it treated as a violation of Chapter 13, subject to the penalties in 13, or is there some other penalty mechanism for an agency or an individual who abused the CRIMNET access?
Ms. Piscicora.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, the intention is to have it subject to the penalty provisions already written into Chapter 13, which can be meted out by the CRIMNET responsible authority.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving on to Section 4, it's kind of a simple idea, and that is we realize that this set of recommendations to you is not the be-all and the end-all. there are discussions that must continue and questions we must continue to wrestle with, and that's what Section 4 is all about. Possible web-based access to CRIMNET by data subjects. It makes us nervous for the reasons we've already discussed this morning, and a collection of other issues which you all can add to, of course, or subtract from at your will. On Section 5, we're beginning now a discussion for the rest of the recommendations having to do with fingerprints, the suspense file at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and accuracy. This system gives us the ability to distribute at great volume information that to date we've only distributed in tiny little dribs and drabs. In other words, we're going from a teaspoon to a fire hose. The consequence of an error when we're distributing information by the teaspoonful is fairly small. The consequence when we're starting to deliver it in great volume can be huge. So every effort that the state government can make to increase the accuracy of these records will serve the people that elected you all to be here. The way we can create greater accuracy is make certain that any conviction records are tied to a fingerprint record, the biometric identifier. The more fingerprints connected to those records, the more confident we can be that if there's a conviction going out with my name on it, it really belongs to me. There are a number of points in the exchange of information between agencies where there historically has been great nervousness on the part of state employees. Therefore, they're going to be sued. Say a court administrator has a fingerprint record, the BCA really wants it, but the court administrator isn't sure there's statutory authority to give it to the BCA. A probation officer has a fingerprint record. Maybe a probation officer has a probationer on a current conviction that probation officer is monitoring, and she realizes that there's a previous conviction to which there is no fingerprint identification attached. Does that probation officer have the authority to go and ask a local police station to fingerprint her probationer and now make certain that there are two fingerprints or two convictions that are validated by fingerprints? So these are the areas we began to discuss. What sort of statutory roadblocks can we clear up to allow a greater transmission of fingerprint records to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension? You've heard the phrase. File. The suspense file is where convictions go when they don't have fingerprints attached to them. There's a group of people that have been involved in our discussions from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the suspense working group. And those folks are spending their time trying to reduce the size of those records in suspense. At one point before they began their work, I think I recall it was 4 out of 10 convictions didn't have fingerprints attached. Just that paperwork never made it from the local police officers with the courts. It just never got attached to the certified copy of the record of conviction. So 4 out of 10. This is an embarrassment in a number of circumstances to the state of Minnesota because there were people out there who had convictions and the BCA had no record of it. And if you all, in your designing of mandated record checks for daycare providers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, buses, bus drivers, taxi cab drivers, home health aides, if you're requiring those employers to check for criminal convictions and they can't find them because they're in suspense, that's a big hole in your big plan to help keep people safe in the hiring process, et cetera. So that's what we get started with in Section 5. And it has to do with people on probation or parole or in custody on in one of the state corrections facilities or county corrections facility, can those fingerprints go to the BCA? Section 5 says yes. Section 6, the new subdivision 1A, says that a prosecutor who's aware of somebody that they've prosecuted, if that conviction is in suspense, that prosecutor can bring a motion to a judge and say, hey, I know that this guy got convicted, and I would like to have you, judge, sign an order to make sure this person is fingerprinted so I can make certain that conviction comes out of suspense. There is some concern because of an attorney general's opinion about the requirement of due process. And I can tell you from my experience representing people who just don't have a lot going on, who maybe are suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome or some other organic brain injury, if you ask them, is this your conviction? They're, you know, nine times out of ten, they say, yep, it sure is. You're, you know, I had clients as a public defender where I'd say, how many convictions do you have? And they'd say, oh, four. Then it would turn out they didn't have any. They got arrested and held in custody overnight and released the next day, and it sure felt like a conviction to them. But they never really had a conviction. So there's a chance, there's a risk here of people over-acknowledging, and then what would that result in? That means they've got a higher score in the sentencing guidelines grid, and they're going to jail for a lot longer than they should, which is both an injustice and an expense. So the idea of having a judge involved and a hearing involved before that individual is fingerprinted was part of the due process discussion that we had. The next is Section 7. It included language saying that prosecutors, courts, probation officers, their agents, etc., shall attempt to ensure that fingerprints are made available. Information on released prisoners is Section 8, and that is the full sort of collection of areas where we had brought to our attention that there were roadblocks preventing fingerprints getting to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Section 9 is a modification of legislation that passed in 2000, giving public defenders electronic access to conviction records. What this does is it makes Chapter 611.272 consistent with court rules, which allows conviction records of prosecution witnesses as well as public defenders' own clients to be available electronically rather than providing that exact same information on paper. That, Madam Chair, concludes my summary of the recommendations that are coming to you from the policy group and the task force. There is more information that you want about the source systems, that is, about the buckets, and Mr. Coy is here to complete the discussion, if you have no further questions of me, by talking about the buckets.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions of Mr. Secor at this time? All right, Mr. Coy. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Ortman, welcome to the committee.
Motion that a prosecutor might be bringing for the fingerprints to connect to suspense files. I'm wondering what kind of showing of need must there be, and how would someone defend against a motion like that? Is there a defense?
Mr. Sequoia.
I can give you some imaginations and say, well, I'm imagining that there would be identity questions. In the circumstance, for example, that I raised before about multiple Robert Johnsons with exactly the same birth date, because that person's liberty interests are at stake, I am assuming that they would have a public defender representing them at that hearing, who would be able to say, "No, this isn't the Robert Johnson," for these reasons. Or my client was in custody in Tucson, Arizona at the time that you are saying he was prosecuted here in Minnesota. So I think one of the questions would simply be identity. This is not the same guy.
Look,
Senator Ortman.
We're talking about identity and not actually relitigating the conviction. Then why do you believe that there would be a defense attorney that would be appointed to help with the issue of identity?
Mr. Sikora.
And again, I'm just guessing, because as soon as an individual's liberty interests are at stake and the chance of them going to jail or going to jail longer are hanging in the balance, at that point, I believe they have a right to counsel. And in this case, because they would be increasing their score on the sentencing guidelines grid, they had one felony before, now they're about to have two, then the potential for them to go to prison longer exists in a very real way. So if they wrongly have a felony attached to their name and have a wrongly inflated criminal history score, I think that's a liberty interest that's protected by the Constitution.
Senator Ortman.
With your example, I thought you talked about a probation officer who has a previous conviction in the file. The liberty interest might not be at stake if that person has already served whatever sentence they might have had in the preliminary or in the first conviction. So then if you're talking about matching the records, the liberty interest isn't at stake. There's a motion in court. I'm not really sure what the level of showing of need is and what they have to show the prosecutors. And then if the liberty interest isn't at stake, that person is there to defend themselves, because if their liberty interest is not at stake, you're entitled to a criminal defense attorney. Isn't that possible?
Yes, Mr. Sequeira.
Madam Chair, yes, I think it is possible.
Do you believe that should be addressed here? What the showing must be and what the defendant might be able to do to disprove the identity or disprove the need on the part of the state?
Mr. Sequeira.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think you're right. I think there could be a standard imposed. I'd have to look at it and see and ask the judges what standard is imposed in such hearings. If there is a rule that sets the standard, is it clear and convincing evidence? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it preponderance of the evidence? I think it's a good question. I think it's worth discussing whether the standard should be set forth in the statute.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Mr. Sequeira, thank you again for your time, efforts. I know it was a rather growing process involving a lot of people, and we appreciate your efforts on behalf of CRIMNET and people of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
You're welcome, Madam Chair.
Mr. Coy, I think if we can move to the next portion of the meeting, and we are going to conclude by 10:30 this morning. I would like your part of the presentation to conclude by 10:15. So if you want to pace the presentations of the next set of information, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to do so. That works with my parking meter perfectly. Before I introduce and walk through some of the systems, I know the paperwork that you have there is fairly voluminous, and I can't expect in this time frame that we can go through all of it, nor that you've had the opportunity to go through with any granularity that you might have specific questions. But we do have with us today representatives of what Mr. Sequeira refers to as the buckets, folks from the CJIS unit at the BCA, from the courts, from Department of Corrections, and even from a system in Carver County that was a part of the CRIMNET pilot. And again, to frame and reiterate some of the issues when we start to talk about the workings of CRIMNET and the respective source systems in CRIMNET today, with some of Mr. Sequeira's comments, today CRIMNET is just that search capability. It is just a portal, that suite of data delivery services, and there is no central or aggregate database that exists. Talking about audit trails, audit logs, indices, registries. These are dependents. Different delivery services might be dependent or better served, more efficient with those types of data collections in the CRIMNET backbone, and those are still for discussion as we look at rolling any of those types of services out. But today there is no database there in question. And as was referenced earlier, with regard and respect to data practices as we move forward and look at different delivery services and information services as they're integrated statewide through CRIMNET, is to remember, to bear in mind that this is dependent on the policy. It's dependent on clear interpretation of the laws and the policy, but as my cohort, Gary Ricciardi, who's our technology director, always says, just tell me how to set the dials. You have to understand is that we've built a extremely flexible platform environment. Now, the applications at the other end are hard-coded, and some of them are older than others, and as we discuss specific to, can CRIMNET operate against that metadata? Absolutely. We've given it that functionality. Do some of those older systems have that metadata? Would we have to have them start telling us what those issues are? Yeah, there would be re-engineering with those systems. But it is an evolutionary process with technology. As new systems are created, they will be in tune with this kind of technology. And we do have the ability to address how security and data practices work together. What kind of access, under what conditions can they have access? How do we acknowledge predication? How do we acknowledge right to know and need to know across this system? It is advanced. It is flexible. We can turn the dials, not just to how we interpret the law and policy as it relates today to these data systems, but as that changes over time and as these systems change. And so we're happy, again, to be able to have or begin this dialogue on how we build those services and how we set those dials, if you will. But as we talk about these data systems today, we have built what we do today as a portal where it does not substantially change in any way what the existing use and access of those systems are. CRIMNET, as this delivery system on top, addresses each of the systems we're about to address with the rules that they were set up with, and we pass through to the users the same agreements that they had. So if you are, for instance, a predatory offender registry, if you are a registered, excuse me, that's a bad word, if you are a authorized user of that system, you have already assigned into the agreements of the data practices and acceptable use policies of that system. That's acknowledged by CRIMNET, and we, without that documentation, we can't pass that service through CRIMNET to you as an authorized user. And as you access information from each of those systems, you are still subject to the guidelines of that source system. As Mr. Sikora also said, I think it is an issue that we have to look at, that although we were not mandated or appropriated money to specifically serve the criminal justice, only criminal justice professionals, and not to look at it as we serve the public, that we do look at those public interests. But to the same extent that we have acknowledged where we are in the development now, the concept of how it was developed, that the public interest in that data still comes from the source of the data as the most reliable way of determining the subject to the source and the use of that data to the subject of the data. That can, in this dialogue over time, change as we see what the balance is between the right to privacy of the individual and the needs of the greater good of the state and society to serve public safety and to do our best to serve both tasks effectively and efficiently. Above all, this is a service suite that was meant predominantly to serve criminal justice professionals, to serve public safety and officer safety, and to deliver better efficiencies, better cost effectiveness by using enterprise functionality across our systems of government. A better idea of the left hand knowing what the right hand is doing, and that quite often comes down into issues of homeland security, issues of officer safety, or the safety of the public. Bear in mind that most of our agencies have a constitutional duty to protect. And a measure of reasonableness and a liability to know or should know what their duty is with respect to their citizens could be construed as information they should have known. And yet at the same time, they have the same trouble that we have understanding what their liability is, what their obligations are to the data they have and the sharing of that data. So on both sides of this issue, we can have individuals who have a liability to protect, to know what they should do and to act to protect, and on the same side, they may fear sharing information because they have a liability of misinterpreting. And so CRIMNET can also be a service to sorting out clear public policy on how those systems can interact, how those agencies can interact. And specific to that, the questions that we have about how do we begin to share across separations of government with court data. But as I said earlier, CRIMNET, I think, can be an effective tool that can improve that process. but it was never one of the fundamental intents or goals. We go through the systems. I believe you have them in front of you in order, so we will go through that order with you. It's at least my opinion, having seen the results that came back from each of the systems and those system administrators, that they fairly adequately answered in most parts and gave you supplements specific to the questions. We can talk with each of the agency and system administrators to give you an idea what the system does and how it responds to the issues of Chapter 13 and the practices. And we can begin with the Predatory Offender Registry. And Ann or Eric, who's here? Eric?
And members, we do not have a packet in the order of the presenters, but we'll start with a document which is numbered 7 in the upper right-hand corner. Looks like this. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Knutson. I'm a senior special agent with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, overseeing the Predatory Offender Registration Unit. What I'd like to do, I just think for ease and simplicity and clarity, is that Mr. Coy has mentioned previously, I don't know if everyone has had the opportunity and chance to see the document that the POR unit has put together in regards to the data privacy issues that pertain to this database. So what I would like to do, Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, is to go through these 19 points that you have asked us to answer. And then if any members of the committee have any questions that pertain today to the answers or the responses that we've given, to feel free to ask, and I'll do the best I can to answer them.
And I would ask that you move fairly rapidly through, because I think we have 5 different databases, but certainly, members, if you have questions as he goes through it, let me know. Thank you, Mr. Knutson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Starting with question number 1, which I think is probably the most pertinent question in regards to our POR database, is how does your system establish and keep track of how the data in the system are classified? We actually have a statute, Minnesota Statute 243.166, Subdivision 7, that states all data in the POR database is classified as private data. And as a result of that, that lends to a lot of the answers that in response to a lot of the other questions that you have in this document, that we don't have a lot of other issues regarding our data because all of it is classified as private. So if I can just quickly go through these other 18 questions that were asked of us. So how does our system manage changes in the classification? The classification of our data doesn't change as a result of that Minnesota Statute 243.166. What are our procedures for public access in the data? Under the current statute, there is no public access to the Predatory Offender Registration Database. Our retention schedule, the records are maintained for the life of the offender 10 years after the date of death. And what's a little bit unique to the Predatory Offender Registration Database is the majority of offenders in this state are required to register for 10 years with some exceptions. However, even after their registration has been completed, if they subsequently commit a crime against a person after their registration has been completed, they can then again be required to re-register so that we reactivate that file again, then their registration period conversely starts all over again. So we retain those records for the life of the offender. What are your procedures for a data subject to access data about him or herself in the system? We do have a mechanism in place where they may submit a written request to the POR unit, and we obviously have talked about identity issues here. We have that same issue in the POR unit where we have several offenders that have similar names or identical names and very close dates of birth. So we do try to make every effort possible to make certain that the information we're giving out is to the correct offender. And so that's why we put in here that responses are mailed to the subject at the address where the subject is currently registered. Now, we also have a mechanism in place where offenders may report to the BCA with proper identification, and we'll also go over their predatory offender registration file with them at that time as well. Question number 6, moving along. Where can the public obtain copies of the procedures? Procedures are available on the Department of Public Safety's website and the Commissioner's Office. Question number 7, procedures for handling a data challenge made by a data subject. We have had this happen on several occasions or an offender claims that he is not required to register, and we allow for that challenge to be made. We have the offender bring in supporting documentation to back that up. We subsequently review that documentation. If it's necessary, we consult with the Attorney General's office for a legal opinion, and then we provide a written response to that predatory offender. And if we have to make necessary changes, those changes are made to the system. How do you flag a marked challenge data in the system? We do have a mechanism that was built in the system to let us know if there's data in it that's being challenged at the time by an offender. We are made aware of that. How do you document when the data has been changed in the system due to a data challenge? Again, we have a documentation function that allows us to know if something's being challenged, and if it's corrected, only the corrected data will appear on the public or on the Criminal Justice Data Network website. Who has access to our system? Our system is very limited in predatory offender registration to law enforcement, corrections, probation, and prison case managers. It's a very, very limited group of people. Now, the responsible authority is the Commissioner of Public Safety, Richard Stanek. Have we complied with the Chapter 1305, Subdivision 1? Yes, and I have provided a copy, Madam Chair. Now, we have a joint powers agreement for access to our system. I have a copy of that if you'd like that. 13, the data practices compliance official is the general counsel for the Department of Public Safety, Lori Beyer-Kropensky. Number 14, how is the system recorded when notice required by Section 1304? The Tennyson warning is required. Again, I brought a copy of our registration form that the offender has to sign. And within that form, there is a line in there that deals with this Tennyson warning that the offender has to review and sign acknowledgement of that. 15, what measures are taken to ensure the security of the system? The system is only delivered over the secure criminal justice data network, which again is a very limited group of people that can review this information. And again, only people that have signed the joint powers agreement have access to this system. We have written rules, procedures for documents. And again, I refer to that joint powers agreement. Again, I brought a copy of that today if your committee would like to see that. What training to provide to the users? The BCA provides courses and training to all of the users free of charge, and we travel throughout the state and make certain that the users of this database are familiar with the application. Well, the consequences of poor misuse of the data. Again, the joint powers agreement spells out what the consequences are. So if your committee has any questions, I can answer those. Otherwise, it is included in that joint powers agreement. I can submit to the committee here. You share and or collect data on individuals from outside the state of Minnesota. We are mandated to do that because we have predatory offenders who move from other states to Minnesota that we have to register, and conversely, we have offenders who move from Minnesota to other states, and we have to share that information as well. So I apologize for the brevity of this, and if the committee members have any questions, I can certainly do the best I can to answer them.
No, I think you did a great job of overview. Are there any questions for Mr. Knutson on the predatory offender registry? Thank you. And if you'd submit copies of the joint powers agreement and the data subject Tennyson warning information, that would be great.
We'll certainly do that, Madam Chair.
Right, thank you, Mr. Knutson.
Thank you.
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if going through all 19 is going to be time permissive here. If we want to continue with that, we can bring up the next system administrator from MRAP, but I think you'll find that the same questions have been asked and answered fairly completely, and a lot of documentation supplied. Again, this is another BCA system. It's a different type of system. If you want a little overview of what the system is and how it operates, we'd be happy to do that for you. But with time constraints, I think you'll find it's under the same jurisdiction in the BCA. It runs under the same requirements of a joint powers agreement and acceptable use agreements. They have attached a copy of 1305 compliance, and again, it runs under standard data practices under the Commissioner of Public Safety and the General Counsel of Public Safety. if you'd like a brief overview of that.
That would be fine. And members, he's referring to documents number 3, 4, and 5 in your packets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's with respect to the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos, and Gail Malinowski from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is here to answer any specific questions, or if you'd like a brief overview of that system.
Mr. McCoy, I'm sorry. I was trying to work here and paper shuffle. What was your question?
Whether you would like Gail Malinowski to give a brief overview or walk through the document?
A brief overview is fine. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for your time. Were you the one that filled out the worksheet for us?
Well, it was a joint effort.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and effort. Appreciate it.
And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having me today. My name is Gail Malinowski. I'm a project manager with the CEJA section of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I worked on the creation and implementation of the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos. As Tom indicated, there are many, many similarities between what you just heard from Eric Knutson and what I'm going to be able to present to you. We both work for the same agency, so we have similar practices in place. So just to quickly run through the list, how does your system establish and keep track of how data in the system are classified? There is no provision to keep track of the data. The data is private, and we have an advisory opinion from the Department of Administration verifying that classification. Does your system manage changes in the classification? There is no change in data classification within the system. It remains private. Procedures for public access. There is no public access because it is private data. And similar to the predatory offender registration, there are public access policies and procedures posted with the Department of Public Safety. The retention schedule for MRAP is currently 99 years. It is consistent with other criminal justice information systems within the CEJIS section. For a person to access data about him or herself, we do have a in-person request form that was included in your packet that's labeled as number 4. They can submit that. Where can the public obtain copies of the procedures, the same as POR from the Department of Public Safety? Procedures for handling data challenges made by a data subject, very similar to what would be, I think, standard throughout many agencies throughout the state. You can come in, verify who you are. One of the unique things between the MRAP and the POR system is that we do not create any of the data in our system. We simply collect it from other agencies. So we do not have the source information to say whether we made a mistake or did not make a mistake. So our position is that we'll work with the individual who says this doesn't have anything to do with me and the agency that says it is that person to try and mitigate that and resolve those issues. There are no provisions in the system at this time to mark a challenged data. It just doesn't exist in the data elements that we collect.
Is that something that you would consider doing? Or is the time frame for these challenges and their resolution fairly short? Or
we have never had a challenged data. This would be, to very, very simply state it, factual data. A person was arrested, brought to a law enforcement facility. They said their name was this, and this is what they were arrested for. I don't know how there would be a provision for someone to challenge that they did or did not say this information about themselves. That might happen at the local agency where the arrest occurred if they misrecorded someone's name. But we have not yet had any challenges. I would think it would be a pretty quick process to do that.
All right, thank you.
Who has access to my system? That is stated in statute, criminal justice agencies as defined by 299C46. The responsible authority, again, is the Commissioner of Public Safety, who is Richard Stanek. You do have a copy of our compliance with 1305 subdivision 1 in your packet. It is not in with the MRAP item specifically, but it was included, I believe, in your packet. Lori Beyer-Kropinski is the general counsel for public safety. Tenants and warnings, this also would be different from the POR unit in that any warnings given at the time of arrest would be done by the booking agency. We never see the subjects that are contained in our database, so we don't have any interaction with them to provide those warnings. The security of the system, again, is the closed CJDN network. Rules and procedures, there are user manuals for those who are accessing the system. The training, there is a training plan with our CJIS training and auditing unit. It is very intuitive. Anyone who's done any web work at all really doesn't need training to use the system. So the training is not a very high priority in our section. Misuses of the data. In the attachment or document number 3, labeled as number 3, the joint powers agreement for MRAP, there are sanctions for the misuse of data stated in there, up to and including criminal prosecution if that's required. And do we share or collect data with individuals from outside Minnesota? We share information within the MRAP only within Minnesota at this time. It's available to Minnesota criminal justice agencies by statute. If a non-Minnesota resident was arrested, that information would become a part of the system.
All right, thank you.
Are there any questions
from the committee members? All right, thank you very much for
thank you very much.
Your testimony and your time and effort in putting together the responses to the worksheet. Members, that document number 14 is the compliance document for the Department of Public Safety and the Data Practices Act. Mr. Coy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the earlier discussion about court data and court data practices in this new world of sharing data, we have with us today the new CIO of state courts, Mr. Bob Hansen, to talk about the understanding and relationship of sharing that court service data in CRIMNet.
And members, the court submitted to us documents A, B, and C in your packet. Welcome to the committee. You guys are kind of a different duck.
My name is Robert Hansen. I'm the director of the Information Technology Division for the State Courts of Minnesota. I'd just like to briefly start with identifying, as Mr. Sikora pointed out, the courts do not operate under Chapter 13, but have rules of access. And Mike Johnson, who's a senior staff attorney, is beside me to answer those complicated and tricky questions if they come up regarding the rules of access regarding court data. The court did complete the worksheet as requested and submitted two supporting documents. The limits on public access of case records is the green, and the teal is the court retention schedule. I just wanted to start out to say that we did give information about each of the source systems that the court uses to assist court operators in conducting the court's business. I point out that the system that's labeled CWA, Court Web Access, is the computer system that feeds information into the CRIMNet viewer or portal. And just another word about Court Web Access, and I'll read from the first page of the document. Court Web Access provides statewide non-confidential information on adult criminal defendants, case information on cases that originated as felonies, most gross misdemeanors, and limited traffic and non-traffic misdemeanors. So in a summary, all we're providing of all of the court records that are computerized at the court are the records that are of a non-confidential adult nature. To quickly try to go through the questions, and rather than going through each of the systems, I'll try to summarize. The first question, how does your system establish and keep track of the data in the system and how they're classified? The operational systems as court cases come into a court clerk and are entered into the computer system by case type fall into various classifications of confidential, non-confidential, as well as when there is a specific component or subcomponent of a case that is of a confidential nature, it is marked from inception and excluded from viewing beyond the court operators, judges, and administrators and partners. Question two, how does your system manage changes in classification of the data? All the changes, classification of the data, are performed by the administrative staff. Audit logs exist for any change in all of these systems. There's detailed lists of any kind of clearance levels available upon request if the committee would like that information. Question three, what are your procedures for public access to the data in the system? Each courthouse in the state of Minnesota has a computer terminal that is logged on during the open hours of the court with a public identification ID that allows any citizen, any person, to access that computer terminal to get to view and take a look at any of the non-confidential court data that's available in the system. Question four, what's your retention schedule? The courts have a formal retention schedule. It's attached. It's extensive, and of course, the volume of records in the court that are computerized is a small portion of all the filings and all of the pleadings and all the exhibits that become part of a case record. And all of that information is attached and available for clarification if needed. What are your procedures for a data subject to access the data? The data in the systems are court records, and as such, the individual can simply contact the court and make the inquiry. Where can the public obtain copies of the procedures? All of the procedures are in Minnesota statutes, as well as available in libraries and other sites of public documents distribution. We're beginning to post those on the court's website so anyone with a computer can access those rules. What are your procedures for handling data challenges made by a data subject? Essentially, if an error occurs in some kind of data entry process, the subject points out the error, and if it is a clerical error, the record is adjusted and corrected at that time. If there is arguments or disputes regarding whether or not the record is accurate, the court has numerous processes for motions being brought by parties involved in cases to remedy that record, and those logs and corrections, hearings, and motions that take place to change a court record are always part of the case and available to the appropriate individuals. Question eight, how do you flag or mark challenge items? When a clerical or data entry type errors are identified, it's changed immediately and there is no marking other than the audit, which includes identification of who the clerk was, when it was changed. Each of those audit or change actions has an opportunity for the clerk to write a comment as to why it was changed or modified. How do you document when data have been changed in the system due to a challenge? Again, for all the systems, we use audit logs and standard computer technology to keep track of who and when and what the circumstances of the change were. Who has access to the system? Primarily, the systems are used by court individuals, judges, court administrators, court staff, contract employees, business partners, and agencies, all under controlled circumstances with passwords, IDs, and logging of activities. Question 11, who is the responsible authority in the data system? Again, Chapter 13 does not apply to the judiciary, but its court rules and equivalent to the responsible authority really resides with designated custodians of the data, and that's primarily the State Court Administration Office. Have you complied with Chapter 1305? If yes, provide a copy. The judicial branch, again, is not subject to Chapter 13 and uses its retention schedule and its public access records as promulgated through its rules of public access. Who's the data practices compliance official for the data in the system? Again, it gets down to the State Court Administrator's Office is where that responsibility resides. Question 14, how does the system record when notice required by Chapter 13? Subdivision 2, Tennyson warning is required. Again, the judicial branch is not subject to Chapter 13, And I don't believe that we have an equivalent to the Tennyson warning. Mr. Johnson could clarify. Question 15, what measures are taken to ensure security of the system? These systems are all using standard security technologies that are current in today's computer environments with firewalls, passwords, IDs, audit logs. We didn't want to go into too much additional detail just because of the public nature of the committee. Number 16, do you have written rules, procedures, or documents for users? Do you have standards for form for data subjects? And please provide copies. We do have training reference materials that we use. We do extensive training for all court employees at each of the courthouses around the state where we have public terminals. We have user manuals so that folks can take a look and understand how to do it. Some of the newer systems, Court Web Access, has online web training and directions for its use. What are the consequences for misuse of the data? Employees of the judicial branch who misuse the data may be reprimanded, terminated, all the appropriate progressive discipline actions are brought forward. Breach of contract of a contract employee violating those rules would also exist. And question 19, do you share and or collect data on individuals from outside the state of Minnesota? Generally, no, unless that the individual or entity is a party to one of the court cases. We're here to answer any questions. Hope the information is helpful in clarifying how these systems work, if there's nothing else.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Hansen or Mr. Johnson, who I think is going to get a pass today? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I think at this time, if we can move to MCAPS, again, that's a kind of a database in progress here. And lots of information on the statewide supervision system in your packets.
Mr. Chris Weldon from the Carver County Attorney's Office is here to talk briefly about MCAPS. And as it was a part of the pilot, the local aspects of the CrimNet pilot this year, along with the courts, went to Carver County where they were implementing their new Mensa system and to try and do some of the local flavor of connecting CrimNet to a local system. The first system was the county attorney system in Carver County. That is extremely limited access except within that county, but Mr. Weldon can speak to that point.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Chris Weldon. I'm the office administrator at the Carver County Attorney's Office. Would you like me to go through the 19 as well?
Certainly, just a general overview, and maybe our members, it's the document number 15 in your packet. Certainly, if you want to do a brief overview of the questions.
Okay, I think our system is a little different from the rest in that it's not available to the general public at all. We did do a brief search project with CrimNet in which I sat down with some members of the CrimNet team, and we tried to devise a way that would, you know, add some search capabilities to our system and to their system. To my knowledge, I was the only one that ever had access to it, and I think that's been taken off now, too, because of it. When they moved, they took it all off their servers, and I don't know if it's been reloaded. I know that I looked at it the other day, and I wasn't able to see it. So, for number one, how our system establishes and keeps track, we just classify our data according to this Minnesota Statute 13 and other related statutes, and that applies to data within our software systems, too. We really don't classify anything in our software package as any type of public, private, or confidential. And number two would be the same answer to that. Procedures for public access. There really is no public access to our system. We purchased it as a third-party commercial software package in 97, and we've been using it for our docketing system, document assembly, and various office directories and things like that. For number four, our retention schedule just depends on the type of data. We really haven't had to purge anything out of the system. Our prosecutors like to keep things at least 10 years for the Spiegel purposes. And like I said, we purchased it in 97, so we haven't had to do anything with taking any data out. Our hard copies, we do have a retention schedule, and we basically follow 13, except in some circumstances with criminal cases, we do keep them longer. Number five, if anybody makes a request, we just reply to the request as in Chapter 13. For the most part, all the information we have is submitted to a defendant by discovery purposes or their attorney, so we really don't have anything in our files that people have asked for. And for number six, if anybody has a question, they generally just come to our office or go through their attorney for any information that they're looking for. Number seven, again, pursuant to Chapter 13. Number eight, we currently don't have a system because it is not a public system. The anticipation would be that a request would put a hard copy in the file. We do have the capability within MCAPS of changing procedural statuses or adding various notes about a case, and we would anticipate that it would be placed in those areas. And that would be the same for number nine. And as far as access to our system, it's just employees in our office. The system administrator of the county, which is our information services department, and our software vendor, who occasionally will send data to him if we're having a problem with bugs or we need an enhancement, things like that. Responsible authority would be our office, and that was established by the Board of Commissioners. And for number 12, we are in the process of updating the manual to comply with the HIPAA provisions, and that should be available within a month, next month. And number 13, again, it's our office, and the chief deputy is the responsible person. In this case, Carrie Myrold is our chief deputy. Number 14, we do not keep track of such notices. They're not required by our office. We generally just receive data from law enforcement, and that's what goes into our system. We don't actively go out and investigate or do any type of questioning of defendants or anyone else. As far as the security of the system, the County Information Services Department has established the backbone or firewall for our system, as well as all the rest within the county. You need to have a password, a username, and then you need to have access to that system, which has to be put on by someone from our Information Services Department. And currently that is only employees in the county attorney office. In terms of written rules or procedures, we really have just our training, internal training. If we have any questions or if people make a request for something, our support staff is usually the people that get it first. They will go to Ms. Myrold or they'll go to the attorney that's assigned to that case to make sure that they can release any data that might be requested. Most of the time it's police reports, which we've already disclosed, or we'll just make copies and give it to them again. In the end, the training is internal. As they become employees, there are also user group meetings that our vendor has probably four a year, and he also has a user group conference once a year that we send employees to for training. Consequences for any misuse: the individual in the county will be subject to Chapter 13 and the internal policies regarding employee misconduct. We use a progressive policy of discipline, and depending upon the circumstances, the county has the right to go as far as they need to. As far as sharing or collecting data from outside the state, we do. Usually it's in the case of if we need to extradite somebody or somebody contacts us about extradition, or if we are prosecuting somebody that has a criminal record in another state. And that's we would attempt to gather that information for our file.
Thank you. I have a couple of quick questions. My understanding is that there's 57 county attorney's offices that are using the same data software program.
That's correct.
Is that correct? And that there's some desire to look at integrating those different systems together so that county attorneys can share information across county lines, is that correct?
There's been talk about that, yes.
All right, and then just for clarification purposes, going back to question 14 relative to the Tennyson warning, when you get information forwarded from law enforcement, is such when, like say when MJNO is still operational, would you get a copy of a printout from other databases as part of the file, or what?
Yes, I have seen them in our file. I don't get as involved in the criminal cases, but I have seen the Tennyson warning, a copy of that for our records.
But did you get copies of, like, MJNO reports?
I've never seen MJNO. I have no idea what it looks like. So I guess I'd have to say no, because I don't know.
Anyways, I'm just a little skeptical about that none of the data that a county attorney's office would need such a warning, and maybe we can phone a friend on this one here.
Well,
in a little bit,
I guess, but we approach it from, we wouldn't be giving the warning because we're not actively collecting the data. We just get it from law enforcement agencies who I think are providing that type of warning.
Right, and I think where the problem comes is that when data is shared, and it shouldn't come to you because the individual hasn't received the proper warning for the use of that data occurring for that purpose, I think is when we've seen other databases get into trouble. So just a point to consider. Any questions for Mr. Walden? All right, thank you. Mr. Clay, do you have any concluding comments? We have Mr. Neumeister wants to speak, and we'll have Mr. Gambrilling help us out here a little bit as well.
On the point of the MCAPs and the consolidation or potential consolidation, that was seen as an opportunity to draw common services to county attorneys, as opposed to some states where they have a district attorney's system in which they have common services, that through the majority of county agencies that were using the same system, that we could deliver the same policies, procedures, and functionality. The key functionality we were looking at with the county system was the ability for them to move their documents and court filings directly between the county attorney's office and the courts. The functionality they had with aspect to search or to look at MJNO records was not part of that functionality. It's again to point out that just because all these systems are connected to CrimNet doesn't mean each user sees them all. And as Mr. Weldon testified, he didn't see MJNO records. Those were not privy to his access. But moving another piece of what CrimNet is meant to be over time is the workflow to be able to push the appropriate information in the appropriate context from, say, law enforcement to the county attorney or prosecutor that's appropriate can be done in the future. And also that in that process we can deliver a common set. As you see, many of the people testifying about these systems, they have these types of agreements, types of compliance issues in place. They're all very similar, and yet it's not real effective in how it's been done, where through CrimNet we can have common joint powers agreements, common compliance, and be able to control that in a more uniform way, more uniform communication of the interpretation and need for compliance across those systems. But with that, I conclude and thank you again very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here and have this dialogue with you today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coy. Any additional questions for Mr. Coy from committee members? Thank you. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. As a courtesy to let you know what I shared with you in before, this is from the U.S. Department of Justice. It was a big task force put together to take a look at the issues of privacy, technology, and criminal justice information. And one of the things, and what criminal justice integration is all about, it's really what CrimNet's all about. And there are some four basic principles that I think that as you start to discuss the legislation and some of the things that are presented to you, could be some good guidance for you. And the whole report is also on the internet if you so desire. Also, there's a copy of Fair Information Practices Survey that was done. Mr. Coy indicated basically that it's buckets and then pipes. Again, perceptually, and how the public and many people will still view it no matter what, the technology does create the big database because of the interconnections. That's what I think people will always look at, that as long as they can get access to information. And then I just want to give some brief comments, because this will be part of your discussion once you come back. I think, is it the second or the seventh? Second? Second Groundhog Day. Remember, this is a copy that you've got. This is a rollout search. What you put in a name and what basically, to some extent, you'll get back. So that's a little bit of a form to use, and, you know, ask the CrimNet staff to give you what the current update is, because it's always changing. Number two, in regards to an area that's kind of unique is where the court data, court information is going to be part of the CribNet process. Talking to Mr. Hansen, currently what will be on there is just criminal justice types of information, criminal information, plus maybe some misdemeanors, limited misdemeanors, and I don't know if he also indicated traffic violations, but he showed me a sheet. But there's, at this point, going to be no civil type stuff, divorce or whatever. But the issue is here, this involves thousands and thousands of Minnesotans who get involved in the system. And if it's going to be used by the executive branch, where they have a very good, solid, hopefully, at least in theory, way to challenge data, and all of a sudden their liberty is going to be detained, you know, they're going to be detained and all the other kinds of things, how are they going to effectively do it, challenge information?
That's a situation in which, you know, the facts kind of came into cosmic alignment, in which you had people losing their jobs, which clearly is a form of damages. But in most cases, that just doesn't happen, okay? In other cases, you know, it's really in talking to people who call about that kind of thing, part of what we say to them is, this is what you're going to have to do to fight through this. And most people, frankly, just say, you know, I don't have the time, I sure enough don't have the money to do it.
Right. Is it likely, given the changing dynamics of moving from a paper system to an electronic system and the building of all this together, that most Tennyson warnings that are currently being used will soon become inadequate given the scope and range of data sharing and dissemination that we're moving into?
Madam Chair, it's interesting that you asked that question, because when I was sitting out here, I was thinking, you really, as a policy-making body, are going back. This may sound strange as we're all going forward with technology, but you're really going back to the roots of the Data Practices Act, which really focused on regulating the relationship between the government and individuals. That's what the Data Practices Act focused on originally. And so I think the question that I think you need to ask if you go forward is whether or not what you've done in the current statutory scheme still works, okay? Because the current statutory scheme, strangely enough, is based on the concept of fair information practice principles. And that's the concept that's still alive and well in most jurisdictions and in the private sector. But the technology developments you've been hearing about bring into question whether or not that works. But I think part of the fundamental question is, will it ever work if the technology folks don't put a priority on it? And, you know, that's the part that I continue to find the most disturbing, because, you know, part of what happens is, if you don't build this stuff in from the get-go, you can talk about it being flexible and all that kind of thing, but at some point the flexibility turns into a cost. And, you know, I'm concerned basically when somebody says, well, this was a statutory mandate to build this system, but we didn't see a priority for this other stuff in building it. I think that's what I heard. Well, you know, what priority is the Minnesota state statute? Okay, now I happen to think, because I spend a lot of time with you, that's a relatively high priority. But, you know, it's obviously got to be a consideration in designing information systems. And we give presentations about that with some regularity. Okay, we try and help the process by providing the information. So I think your question really goes to whether or not you got now will work for what's coming at you in the future. And the future is obviously now.
Right. Thank you. Representative Watts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gemberling, you raised a real concern, I think, about the ability to enforce the provisions of the Data Practices Act, the unusual case being a lost job and easily calculated damages, the more common but more difficult case being one in which someone just wants their data and they can't get it, or some data is released that shouldn't have been. It's very difficult to calculate what the consequences of that are to people. And even the worst irony is that if they challenge it or they seek to enforce it, they could compound the damage by further spreading the public knowledge of data that might have been calculated or classified as private. Do you have any suggestions for a better enforcement mechanism? The first thing that jumped to my mind, I'm not suggesting it at least, but just for purposes of consideration, would be liquidated damages provision or a fee-shifting arrangement or something that would give some ability for private individuals who don't have a lot of resources to go out and hire attorneys to get some compensation or have some effect and some ability to enforce the Data Practices Act.
Mr. Gimberling.
Madam Chair, Representative Latz, what's been done over several sessions, including last session, is variations on the theme of trying to beef up what is the traditional kind of remedy, i.e. suing people. So last session you said that if a citizen gets an opinion from us and the agency doesn't change its behavior and they go into court and the facts are essentially the same, then the judge doesn't have a choice about attorney's fees, they award attorney's fees. Well, I haven't seen any cases so far. So I think some of the other difficulties you indicated about suing from the get-go still are driving what's happening. So, you know, I think you can continue to try variations on the theme, liquidated damages, that kind of thing, civil penalties, whatever. I mean, those are the kind of things you can try. The other possibility, and some of you have heard this from me before, is that you go to a different model. You go to a different dispute resolution model. A few years ago, you gave the Commissioner of Administration the authority to essentially hear these kinds of matters, try and resolve them informally, and then if need be, take them to the Office of Administrative Hearings as a contested case. Currently, that's what we do with data challenges. However, the Ventura administration wasn't willing to support that with funding, okay? Because there wasn't going to be money to do it, we recommended to our management that we recommend to you to get rid of it. So, you know, what's used in other places, and I think used effectively, and frankly it's effectively outside of this country, is the Canadians essentially use a model of having an office in which people are assigned to investigate allegations of violations of their respective freedom of information and data privacy laws. That office essentially operates in a kind of a two-tiered system. They first try and resolve matters informally, get the agency to change its behavior. If that doesn't work, then they take them through some kind of hearing process in which they have the ability to order changes and in some cases even to assess damages. So those are kind of two models that are really different, and there's obviously variations in between, but I think it's a real good thing to think about is how do you get compliant? Because that's the fundamental issue.
And Representative Latz, for overtime, if you have a brief follow-up, but certainly I know Mr. Gimberling would be willing to talk to you about it in the future as well.
Thank you. I'll just one quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Mr. Gimberling, are there any, to your knowledge, are there any current comparable institutions in Minnesota state government to what you've described as a Canadian model? I mean, what comes to mind for me, at least in some form, is the Crime Victim Ombudsman's Office before it lost its independence.
Mr. Gamberling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lance, the model that was put into statute a couple of years ago with having a Commissioner of Administration with more expanded authority was really based on the model that's present in the Department of Human Rights. Okay, I don't think anybody thought that there would be that extensive of an office, but it's essentially it's the same kind of model. Attempted resolution by a government entity, and if the resolution isn't brought about by mediation or whatever, then you go to the next step, which is to go to a contested case.
Thank you. Members, thank you for your time. The meeting's adjourned.